The broadcast is off.
Good evening and welcome to another one of our American Herbalist Guild webinars. And tonight it's my pleasure to introduce one of our founding members, David Winston, who's one of my personal favorites as a teacher and a very good person at helping you understand, you know, the specifics of what specific herbs are for and how to use them in a much more sophisticated manner than you see in the common advertising materials, see. So, David, tell us about the worst weeds and why they're our best medicine.
Well, thank you, Stephen. Thank you, and good evening, everyone. Pleasure to be here with you tonight. So, basically, the worst weeds are your best medicine is a class that I've been teaching in various incarnations probably for the last 30 years. And this is an idea that came to me a long time ago, as I said. And the idea is this. You know, we focus in on using all these incredible indigenous American plants. The problem is so many of them are threatened or endangered species. So we're still using things like American ginseng, and we're still using things like trillium root and helonius. And these are great herbs. But the problem is that most of them are not growing in enough density to be sustainable. So the idea that I had was, is, well, you know, there are all these incredibly weedy plants. Some of them are indigenous weeds, like things like goldenrod, and other ones are introduced weeds, and here they are. They are incredibly aggressive. In many cases, they take over huge amounts of our environment ecosystems. They upset various ecosystems. We spend probably millions or hundreds of millions of dollars a year spraying herbicides on them in attempt to control these aggressive plants. And why aren't we using them as medicine? And so the idea was is to teach people, and of course some of the plants that we're not going to cover tonight, the common ones, things like nettles and dandelion and burdock and yellow dock, yes, they're very weedy and people know about them. But I was wanted to focus in on the weedy plants that are usually medicines and they're used someplace else in the world. So things like Japanese knotweed, which is commonly used in Chinese medicine, but until recently was virtually never used here by American herbalists, or things like honeysuckle or ground ivy or a whole range of plants, again, that are incredibly aggressive, very weedy. They threaten our environment. We spend huge amounts of money trying to eradicate them, plus the use of herbicides, which, of course, is environmentally damaging. And so the idea is we can change by changing what we are using, by altering our choices of medicinal plants. And if we have three plants that all have similar indications, and one of them is a threatened species, and two of them are common weeds, why wouldn't we choose to use those? And then, of course, the other issue is that a lot of the plants that people are buying, I cannot tell you how many times, you know, I'll order something from, you know, various herb companies. When we're talking about bulk herbs, and the reason I mostly get them is because we provide, my two-year herb studies program, we provide samples of herbs to virtually every herb we cover, which is about 330. We provide samples to our students so that while I'm talking about the herbs and while they're seeing a picture of the herb, they're also smelling the herb, they're making tea out of that herb, because, of course, the more you can do that, the better. I cannot tell you how many of the samples we get, of the materials that we get of herbal products, are just inferior quality. So if you have this incredibly aggressive weed growing in your backyard, growing in your garden, growing in your farm, and you can go out and get it, you can reduce the spread of it by harvesting it, you can weed your garden and get medicine, and not only do you have this medicine that costs you absolutely nothing except your labor, but you also have this medicine that is fresh, that is strong and powerful and potent, and that's what we want in our medicines. So for so many reasons, there are so many of these plants that, as I said, are these aggressive weeds, that grow around us. And again, they have a long history of use. They have a history of use in Chinese medicine, in Ayurvedic medicine. They have a history of use by native people, by the eclectics, by other traditional systems of medicine. And in many cases, it's simply that as American herbalists, most American herbalists, having not studied these other traditions, simply are not familiar. So we'll start off by talking about asters. And of course, as you can see, we list Aster punaceus, Aster tartaricus, Aster cordifolius, Aster nova anglii. There's a lot of different asters. Now, you cannot assume that they are all the same. That is a common misconception. So somebody will say, well, viburnum prunifolium, which is black haw, is a great medicine, so therefore any viburnum is going to be a good medicine. And in the case of viburnum opulus, which is cramp bark, black haw and cramp bark are pretty much synonymous in their use, but then you have other species of viburnum which have no similar activity whatsoever. So you cannot always extrapolate that just because a plant is in the same genus, it has the same activity. It could have no activity. It could be stronger. It could be weaker. It could have potential toxicity. So you really need to know your plant. So just be careful about sort of assuming that one thing can be, you know, interchangeable. Now, one of the things that I love is that in New England, we have the New England aster, the Aster nova anglii, and this is an amazing herb. And one of the things I do is I use the flowers. And actually, I learned this from a wonderful herbalist who lives outside of Detroit named Jim McDonald. And he uses it for spasmodic coughs. And the herbs that I traditionally use for spasmodic coughs, one of the best ones is sundew or drosera. But sundew is a threatened species. Now, granted, there are places where it is prolific and it is actually locally abundant, but in general, sundew, which is a carnivorous plant and it grows in bogs, is a threatened species. So do I really want to encourage people to keep using sundew? And the answer is no. Yet, I don't, you know, there aren't that many plants that are the equivalent of something like sundew, but while aster is a little bit milder, it is also potentially less toxic. And again, for those dry spasmodic coughs associated with asthma, dry spasmodic coughing in general, or dry asthma, aster flowers, especially the New England aster, are phenomenally useful. They are truly effective. Now, another aster, which is the purple stem aster, which is Aster punaceus, really interesting, because if you go back and look at the eclectic literature, and I would hope that these days all the great eclectic books, and of course for those of you who are not familiar with the eclectics were herbal MDs that practiced in the United States from about 1825 through the 1930s and even some into the 40s and 50s. It's amazing to think that there were MDs that were primarily using herbal medicine well into the last century. And so, you know, in my case, I didn't discover the eclectics even existed until probably around 1975. And if I had actually known more, I assumed, because the initial eclectic books that I came across were all from the 1850s and 60s, I assumed that this was something that was extinct. If I had known better, in 1975, I probably could have still found one or two eclectic that were still alive who I could have actually sat and learned from and listened to their stories. Unfortunately, those of us who discovered the eclectics, by the time we did, they were probably all pretty much gone. Anyway, the eclectic literature, you have things like King's Dispensatory and Ellingwood's Materia Medica and Felter's Materia Medica. These are phenomenal books, and they are just filled with amazing material that is based on well over 100 years of clinical experience. And so while these books can be expensive to buy, although they're probably available as e-books or as print on demand, and they're much cheaper, you can just go onto different websites and actually look at this literature, so you don't need to actually own the book at all. And they, as I say, are filled with the most amazing material. So for instance, the purple stem aster, the Aster punaceus, was used basically as a diaphoretic. It was used to treat things like pneumonia. It was used to treat tuberculosis and is an emetagogue. And John King, who is one of the great eclectic physicians, used the root of purple aster, and he believed it was a very effective nervine and antispasmodic. And a nervine, of course, being a nerve tonic. And I want to just mention, I was teaching out in Phoenix last weekend, and one of the classes that I taught was a class on nervines. And one of my pet peeves is that within the herbal community, we use a lot of archaic language, and there's nothing wrong with using archaic language. So our concepts of nervines and things like alteratives, there's nothing wrong that we're using this very, very old language. The problem is that we use it rather imprecisely. And so if you have five herbalists and you ask them what a nervine is, you're probably going to get five somewhat different answers. So one of the things I think is really important is herbalists, especially if we want to share what we know and share it into the wider community, which of course is one of my great goals in life, is to bring herbal medicine back to its rightful place in American culture, which means that it is a part of American culture, not alternative, not complementary, but a part of American culture. I actually have this idea that I want to see a time within my lifetime that every mother, father, grandmother, and grandfather knows basic kitchen herbal medicine for their families, that there are community herbalists in every community and clinical herbalists in every clinical setting. And while that is still a very big dream, it is possible. So anyway, we need to spread the word of these things. And so a nervine, in my mind, people say it's a nerve tonic, but then they'll talk about sedatives like they're a nerve tonic. Sedatives are not a nerve tonic. Sedatives sedate. They actually weaken the nervous system if they are used excessively. They make you feel groggy the next morning. Nervines, as a nerve tonic, nourish the nervous system, and they give you a feeling of calm and relaxation, but they don't sedate you. They don't put you to sleep. So you can take a nervine throughout the day, and you don't have to worry about that it's going to make you sleepy or tired, whereas a sedative certainly would. Basically, again, there are lots and lots of other asters, and I would maybe just point out one of the other ones that I would mention, and that is in Chinese medicine, aster tartaricus, which is called zhurwan, is used, again, for coughs due to what are called wind cold, and that would be somebody who has a spasmodic cough with white mucus. It's also used in addition for wind heat, and that would be a spasmodic cough with yellow mucus. And then it depends on, you know, you would add in other herbs. If it's a heat condition, you'd add in some other cooling herbs. If it's a cold condition, you'd add in other warming herbs like a ginger or orange peel or thyme or something like that. So most people look at asters and they say, wow, that's a really attractive or pretty autumn wildflower. Next time you look at an aster, start thinking, wow, that's an amazing medicinal plant. Stephen, next slide, please. So barberry. And, you know, barberry is actually somewhat well-known. I mean, most American herbalists are familiar with barberry, and for the most part, the part of barberry that's used is the root. And barberry root, if you, you know, dig up the root, it is bright yellow, and it is full of isoquinoline alkaloids, especially a yellow one called berberine. And berberine, of course, turns out to be a really interesting compound. And we, of course, know berberine is also found in golden seal, and it's found in Oregon grape root. It's found in what's called shrub yellow root or yellow root, Xanthoresia simplicissima, which grows in the southeast. It is found in the Chinese herb, Chinese coptis. It's found in the gold thread that grows up in the New England area up to Canada. And so it is not an uncommon compound, and berberine is incredibly bitter. Well, lots of interesting research on isolated berberine over the last five or so years showing berberine has not only significant antibacterial activity, which we actually already knew, but it also lowers blood sugar levels. It has anti-tumor activity. So very interesting. But just be aware that we cannot necessarily extrapolate that pure barberry does something, that pure berberine does something, that barberry will do the exact same thing. Now, with barberry, though, it has, as I said, has a long history of use. This is, we're talking about barberry now, not berberine. It has a long history of use for infections. So it's used for things like gastric or gastrointestinal infections. So it's used for things like diarrhea. It's used for helping to treat gastritis and gastroduodenal ulcers. Also used to treat things like dysentery. It's also used for upper respiratory tract infections, although I think it's less effective there. And again, it's used for things where you have basically damp heat, and that means damp heat means there's a lot of mucus, and it's going to be yellow, green, or bloody. Those are all the things that would tell you you have a damp heat lung condition. It is also of benefit for urinary tract infections, and this can be used for everything from simple cystitis to part of a protocol for something like urethritis or nephritis, which is an infection of the kidney. It also is really useful orally for things like gum disease, so gingivitis and other types of gum disease. Barberry works really quite nicely. It can also be used as a mouthwash for thrush. It can also be used in a very finely filtered saline eye wash for simple conjunctivitis. It can be used orally and topically for acne rosacea. It can be used as a nasal douche for fungal or bacterial sinusitis. It can be used as a vaginal douche or a bolus for a vaginal candidiasis. So it has antifungal activity. It kills yeasts, which are basically in the fungal family. It kills bacteria, and really effective for all those things. Now, one of the specific indications, now one of the things about the eclectics that was really interesting is that when they looked at herbs, they tried to learn to identify the specific activity that an herb had on each specific system. And they would call those sort of short descriptions of exactly what the herb did the specific indication, or what homeopaths would call the black letter symptoms. So both Oregon graperoot and barberry, the specific indication are basically these large red pimples that occur on the back, neck, or buttocks. Most of the time, you only see these in men. And so if you are a man and you are in a locker room, sometimes you'll see another guy and they have these large red pimples on the back. And these are usually pimples. They don't come to a head. They're painful. And Oregon grape and barberry are actually quite specific for this. They can be used both orally, and you could use them topically if you wanted to as well. But they actually, in this case, they primarily work orally. These pimples are what are known as comedones. And they basically have to do with impaired liver detox and usually impaired bowel detoxification of androgens. So these are people who have very high androgen levels. So you see it in men, but you also see it in women, especially women who are overweight, who have PCOS, polycystic ovarian syndrome, and it works just as well for them. Now, one of the interesting things about barberry is you're looking at the barberry, and we're not looking at a picture of the root. We're looking at a picture of the berries. And generally speaking, I've known probably most of my, virtually my entire herbal career, and I started studying herbal medicine 45 years ago. I always knew, remember learning very early, that barberry's fruits were edible. And they're really sour. And so if, you know, you can make a jam or a jelly out of them, but in general, you're going to be adding a lot of a sweetener to make it really palatable. But what's very interesting to me is that in Iran, and by the way, I mean, I know our government doesn't get along with Iran, but one of the fascinating things is Iran has turned into one of the sort of hotbeds of human clinical research on herbal medicine. And part of that may be because of the, simply because of the bans that we have, you know, they can't import a lot of stuff because of our government. So it's possible that they turn to herbal medicine to replace the fact that they can't get a lot of pharmaceuticals. I'm not sure if that's the case, but they are doing a lot of herbal research. And so in Iran, barberry fruits are traditionally used as a medicine, and this is something that was relatively new to me. And they found that, for instance, barberry, the fruit taken orally, inhibited acne in teenagers. In adults, with people with type 2 diabetes, taking the berries, and again, they would be ground up, powdered, probably put in capsules, or you could tincture them. In people with type 2 diabetes, it reduced triglyceride levels, total cholesterol, blood sugar, and insulin levels. I mean, these are some pretty interesting things, and it's also traditionally used to treat hypertension. It's used to reduce allergic response, and of course, that red color in the berries, you know that these berries have significant amounts of procyanidins, the procyanidin oligomers, which are the sort of double-bonded flavonoids, which are anti-inflammatory and help reduce mast cell degranulation and histamine response. So it's absolutely, they help with allergies. It was also shown to protect the liver against liver damage caused by things like carbon tetrachloride and acetaminophen. And so why? Because it has that quote-unquote antioxidant effect. Now, let's go on a little aside, and I know that people want to get to as many herbs as possible, and I certainly will try, but this is something I think you might find interesting. Obviously, I can't hear you, but if I ask you a question, and that question being is, what do antioxidants do? I would say we've got almost 200 people online at the moment, and I would say that virtually everybody would raise their hand and say, oh, antioxidants quench free radicals. Well, guess what? It turns out that's not true at all. We've been told this for about 30 years, but that's not true. And in fact, if antioxidants were actually quenching free radicals, they would probably be harmful, because it turns out that the quote-unquote free radicals, which are reactive oxygen and reactive nitrogen species, are actually necessary. They trigger our own cellular production of cellular antioxidants, things like reduced glutathione, catalase, superoxide dismutase. And so if you actually suppress these compounds in a significant way, so it's possible antioxidants do it a little bit, but if you were doing it in a significant way, you would be suppressing the cellular and mitochondrial antioxidants we need for our cells to work. And the newest research, what it shows is that what quote-unquote antioxidants are actually doing is they are triggering genes, and they trigger something called the antioxidant responsive element on genes and act as systemic anti-inflammatories. And we always knew that as antioxidants they had anti-inflammatory activity. It's just we didn't understand why they were doing it, and in fact we were sort of coming up with these reasons that turned out not to be true. It's always fascinating when you learn some new things like that. Also, one last thing about Barbie, and now I'm going back to talking about the root. Berberine, especially pure berberine, bacteria can learn to become resistant to it. And so with barberry, while it's less likely bacteria will become resistant to barberry because it's not just one single molecular compound, it's a whole range of chemicals, it turns out that if you take barberry leaf with the root, there is a chemical in the leaf that basically inhibits the multicellular, the multi-drug resistant pumps in bacteria, and they have those same pumps in cancer cells as well. And there is also research showing the same thing is true with golden seal. If you take golden seal leaf with the root, it basically inhibits the multi-drug pumps, resistant pumps in bacteria. What the bacteria do is they learn to sequester these chemicals that damage them, including antibiotics, and then pump them right out of the cell. Well, if you take the barberry leaf with the barberry root, it basically disables those pumps so that the barberry or the antibiotics or whatever you're using works better. I think it's pretty cool. Stephen, next slide, please. So our next plant that we'll be looking at in just a minute is Canada fleabane, Canisa canadensis. It used to be known as Erigeron canadensis, and the essential oil is still often called oil of Erigeron. Now, the essential oil is really interesting. If I have somebody who has bleeding issues, and, you know, we probably, all of you are familiar with herbs to help stop bleeding. You know of yarrow. You might know of shepherd's purse. You might know of cinnamon. But in reality, by far, the strongest herb to help stop bleeding is a Chinese herb called Tianqi ginseng, which is Panax Noto ginseng. Unfortunately, Tianqi, at the moment, they had pretty much a total crop failure in China last year. And so, excuse me. So unfortunately, it's unavailable. One of the other things that is probably the most effective for treating internal bleeding. Now, we're not talking about artery or our venous bleeding. We're talking about capillary bleeding. So we could be talking about epistaxis, a nosebleed, hematuria, blood in the urine, hemoptysis, coughing blood. We could be talking about vomiting blood. We could be talking about blood in the stool, profuse menstrual bleeding. For any of those sorts of things, again, generally speaking, and especially things like dysfunctional uterine bleeding, which is often associated with perimenopause or fibroids, one of the things that works really well is an old eclectic formula. And what they did is they took one drop of essential oil, one or two drops of essential oil of origuron, which is Candida fleabane, and mixed it with one or two drops of essential oil of cinnamon. And this would be the Saigon cinnamon. And so you have these two essential oils, just a drop or two of each, and they would put it on a sugar cube. And you would just suck on the sugar cube. And the reason for that is the essential oils do. The cinnamon's fine, but the origuron's not going to win any taste awards for sure. But it's very effective. It's called Ellingwood's compound. Very, very effective for helping to stop bleeding. Now, you can also use Candida fleabane as a tea or as a tincture to stop bleeding. But here's the thing with Candida fleabane. It is extremely drying. So for people with what in Chinese medicine would be called yin deficiency, dry mouth, dry cough, dry eyes, vaginal dryness, dry skin, you do not want to use Candida fleabane because it'll make the dryness worse. But for somebody who has bleeding and has lots of signs of dampness, so they might have everything from excessive sweating to a damp cough, that would be profuse amount of mucus, they might have diarrhea, if there are signs of dampness, then this herb can work really, really well. You can also use it topically as a sitz bath for things like helping support episiotomy incisions. So women after giving birth who've had episiotomies, you can do a bath of Candida fleabane. You could also do yarrow instead, maybe with a couple drops of essential oil of lavender mixed in, and it helps prevent infection, and it helps to stop bleeding and promote healing really dramatically. Candida fleabane can also be used as a tea for people with really nasty watery diarrhea, dysentery. It also can be useful for people with inflammatory bowel disease where there is either a really profuse mucus discharge like mucus colitis or where you have a lot of blood in the stool, which you often see with things like Crohn's disease as well. Now, it's not going to cure Crohn's disease, but it can help to stop the bleeding and help stabilize bowel tissue. And I know that I'm going fast, and if people have questions, there is a question and answer period, which we will be at about 8 o'clock, and so I will be happy to try to get to all your questions at that point. Our next herb is chicory. And, you know, most people, if they know of chicory, they know of chicory as a quote-unquote coffee substitute. And, yes, the roots can be roasted, and they has a pleasant sort of bitter flavor. Personally, I don't think it tastes all that much like coffee, but some people like it. And in fact, some of the French roast coffees actually include chicory, which gives it increased bitterness. Now, chicory is wonderfully common. It is a really scraggly looking plant. It's not really very pretty until you have a sunny day when it's in flower and the flowers open up. By the way, they close when it gets cloudy or dark. The flowers are gorgeous. They are this gorgeous, as you're seeing, this gorgeous shade of blue. And while the plant itself is nothing to look at, the flowers are lovely. But the part that we really use is the root, although there is a Bach flower remedy, of course, made out of chicory flowers. So the root of chicory, and generally speaking for herbal purposes, we don't want the roasted root. By roasting the root, you actually damage some of its activity, not all of it, but some of it. First off, chicory root is a very rich source of inulin. And inulin, which is also found in dandelion root and Jerusalem artichoke, inulin contains what is known as FOS, fructooligosaccharides. These are compounds that act as prebiotics. Now, you've probably all heard of probiotics. So you have your bifidobacteria and your acidophilus. Those are probiotics. Prebiotics are things that you give with probiotics, and the combination is what is known as a symbiotic. And when you use them together, think of chicory root as miracle grow for your intestinal flora. I mean, how many of you have taken antibiotics and then took probiotics and it didn't seem to help that much? Well, first off, there's a lot of not very good probiotic products in the marketplace. That's number one. But one of the problems is that when you get bacterial overgrowth of pathogenic bacteria, it changes the pH of the gut. Therefore, when you're taking your probiotics, it's a little bit like throwing really high-quality seeds on an asphalt parking lot. It's just most of them aren't going to sprout and most of them aren't going to take root because it's not a good environment for them. So you take the probiotic with the prebiotic, in this case the inulin in the chicory root, and only the healthy gut flora can digest inulin and the FOS. The pathogenic bacteria cannot. So basically what you're doing is stimulating the growth of the flora that you want. And for those of you who are unfamiliar with the intestinal microbiome, the research that has been done over the last 5 years is absolutely mind-blowing. It is astonishing. In fact, the gut flora in your bowel is responsible for more biotransformations than your liver and kidneys combined. And some people are saying that the gut microbiome should be considered, in a sense, its own organ, except it's an organ that isn't you. It turns out that 90% of the DNA in and on your body isn't you. Only 10% of the DNA found in our body is us, and 90% is bacteria that lives in us and on us. Pretty cool stuff. Anyway, so chicory root is a great bitter tonic. It is a cholagogue. It's a mild hepatoprotective agent. And so as a bitter tonic, you know, bitter is the most profoundly powerful and physiologically active taste we have. And most Americans don't like bitters. If you didn't grow up eating them, most Americans are like, oh, I'm bitter. But bitters stimulate saliva secretion, they stimulate gastric HCL secretion, they stimulate pancreatic juices, small intestine juices, bile secretion, bile excretion. Bitters stimulate the entire process of digestion, absorption, and elimination. So we need to encourage people to use more of these bitters. And I think chicory root and dandelion root are almost interchangeable when it comes to being one of our best sort of gentle liver tonic. You know, if you have somebody who basically has been eating a really high-fat diet, they eat fats, they get bilious, you know, sort of low-grade nausea, they eat fats and they get sort of, you know, greasy diarrhea. People like that, they don't need milk thistle. Milk thistle is to build the liver. You have somebody, milk thistle is for somebody with liver damage. So you have somebody with elevated, you know, liver enzymes, elevated alkaphosphatidylirubin, GGT. Then you need something like milk thistle. But for the average person whose liver is okay, it's sort of just like they need an oil change. Instead of sending them to Jiffy Lube, which probably won't help, give them chicory, give them dandelion, and it works as a gentle, mild liver tonic. It enhances excretion of wastes, it promotes liver function, and mildly tonifies the liver, and it works incredibly well. Moving along, because again, we have a lot of herbs, and I probably won't get to everything I'd love to talk to you about, but we'll do our best to cover them. Kogan grass, Imperata cylindrica. This is a plant that was brought into the United States as a ornamental. It's one of those ornamental grasses. And especially in the southeastern United States, it has escaped cultivation and has become a major nuisance weed. So most people look at this and think, wow, this is this horrible weed. We've got to get rid of it. Yet this is a major Chinese medicine. In Chinese medicine, it's called Bai Mao Gun. And the root is the part used. Now, some of you may know of an herb known as couchgrass. And let's see, do we cover couchgrass? No, we don't. Couchgrass or twitchgrass or witchgrass or doggrass has lots of common names. It's Elatrigia repens. I had to think about that one for a minute because it's had three different Latin names in the last 30 years. Before that, it was Elatrigia repens, and then it was Alimus repens, and before that it was something else, which escapes me at the moment. Anyway, this is related to that, but the roots here are way bigger. Couchgrass, if you have a garden, there's a good chance you have couchgrass. and the roots are very, very thin rhizomes, actually rhizomes, and then which has rootlets off of it. And it is really wonderful for irritation of the genitourinary tract. Well, Kogon grass works just as well. So for anybody with burning urination, anybody with things like interstitial cystitis is a chronic inflammation of the urinary tract where there's no cultural, you know, you can't culture a bacteria or anything like that. It's just this chronic long-term inflammation. It can be wonderful for soothing the urinary tract, especially good for irritation of the urinary tract with bleeding. Because Kogon grass also helps to stop bleeding, so it's used for hematuria. In addition, it can be used for other types of bleeding as well, but you need to use fairly large doses and combine it with other stronger herbs, things like TNG ginseng, yarrow, agrimony, for other types of bleeding. So that would be things like menorrhagia, nosebleeds, gastric bleeding, things of that nature. Kogon grass is also used for, in Chinese medicine, what is known as damp heat jaundice. What does that mean, damp heat? Well, damp means that there's a lot of fluid or a lot of a discharge, and heat means inflammation or infection. So a damp heat jaundice, generally speaking, we're talking about something like a damp heat jaundice. We're talking about something like hepatitis. And so Kogon grass, the root, is used with other herbs to treat hepatitis. It also helps to relieve heat and inflammation in the stomach, so it can be used for gastritis, gastric ulcers, and it can also be used for hot, dry coughs. And this, again, hot means that if there's mucus, it's yellow, but if it's dry, it means it's really hard to expectorate, and the mucus is really sticky and stringy, and there's not much of it. And that would be a hot, dry cough, and this herb works really well. Next slide, please, Steve. So dodder, many of you are probably familiar with dodder, and if you've ever come across it, it looks like sort of orange spaghetti growing on another plant. And dodder is actually parasitic on other plants. I find it most often growing on plants like jewweed, a shrub called buttonbush, purple loosestrife. I've also seen it though in gardens. I've seen it growing, you know, parasitizing somebody's carrots. So the thing about dodder is there are two parts of dodder used. In Chinese medicine, they use the seed. It's called tusizi, and that is spelled exactly the way it sounds. I'm joking. It's T-U-S-I-Z-I. Now, for those of you, some of you may be trained in Chinese medicine, I have some bad news for you. Dodder seed seems to be a lead accumulator. And, you know, as a person who does have an herb company, and I'm not going to talk about my company, but this is reference to dodder, is that we test everything. And we test everything, especially anything coming out of China. Anybody who's using stuff coming out of China is not doing, you know, heavy metal screening and pesticides and all that kind of stuff, is not doing their due diligence, because we know that there are serious quality control issues in some of the materials coming out of China. And it's not just herbs. It's all sorts of things. So you need to do that due diligence. And for years, we started testing dodder many, many years ago, and virtually 7 out of every 10 batches of dodder had lead levels that were off the charts. Now, granted, China is also one of the most polluted countries in the world. But, and by the way, trying to gather dodder seed is, I'm not even sure how they do it, because it would be so labor-intensive. But dodder seed is a great medicine if you can get it and you know that it's clean and safe. And so traditionally, dodder is used to strengthen, the seed is used to strengthen the eyes. It's used as what in Chinese medicine is called a kidney yang tonic, so it's used for low back pain. It's used for weak knees, weak ankles, premature ejaculation, lack of libido. All of those things are associated with kidney yang deficiency. It was also used for what's called deficient liver and kidney yin, which includes symptoms like tinnitus and dry eyes and things of that nature. So it has a bunch of different uses, but again, I'd be cautious about it unless you're absolutely sure that you're in an area where lead is not an issue. You would never want to gather it near a highway, because there is still lead in the soil from, you know, when we used to use leaded gas. Now, on the other hand, the vine of dodder is used in Cherokee medicine. And so here we have an herb, and, you know, according to Cherokee tradition, dodder is known as Dahlonega'i, which means yellow. Dahlonega'i means yellow, gold, or orange. They're all the same thing. And things that are of that color are believed to affect the liver. Now, you know, don't assume this always means it's good for the liver. Daffodils are yellow, and they will kill you by damaging your liver. But in this case, dodder is used as a gentle, mild liver tonic. It's used to stimulate bile secretion. It's used to stimulate bile excretion. Dodder vine is definitely something that people can also consider using. It was used for what's called hepatic torpor, which is basically chronically clay-colored stools. You know, the stool is sort of the color of a manila envelope, and that's because there's a lack of bile secretion. And, of course, it was traditionally used for people who had clay-colored stools, especially with a very slow transit time or with constipation. Next slide, Stephen. And moving along, we have an herb that, you know, this is kind of a funny herb. This has become very common in the southeast and parts of the southwest, eclipta. And in the in Chinese medicine, it is always referred to, I believe, as eclipta prostata or alba, one of the other. And in the Ayurvedic literature, it is referred to as the other one. And it took me years to figure out that eclipta prostata and eclipta alba and eclipta erecta, which in different books are all referred to, which I thought were different species of related plant, it turns out they're all the exact same plant. And so eclipta is really interesting. It's known in Ayurveda as Beringaraj. It's known in Chinese medicine as Hanliansao. And this is a plant it's used in two of the great systems of medicine in the world, being Chinese medicine, TCM, and Ayurveda. And as I said, it's become a naturalized weed here, and eclipta is used for a lot of things. Eclipta is used as a neuroprotective. It is used as a cerebral tonic. It is used to help treat things like dizziness, tinnitus, blurred vision. It's even used topically and orally for people who have premature balding and premature graying of the hair. So in addition to that, it's also used for helping to stop bleeding, although it's not the strongest herb for that. I would always combine it with other stronger herbs for that sort of thing. And it is topically, it makes a phenomenal antifungal agent. It's antibacterial. It is a topical styptic. And interestingly enough, in both Southeast Asia and South America, which it seems like they probably would have come to this somewhat on their own, very different parts of the world, it's used to treat venomous snake bites. I used to think, and this was, you know, one of the things about being an herbalist is, well, this is just my philosophy. You can do whatever you like, but I don't believe in sacred cows. And so I'm always open to the fact that anything that I think that I know could turn out to be wrong. And I've been wrong many, many, many times. Things that I thought and believed for years, I finally, you know, turn out not to be accurate. But in the case of snake bites, for a long time I thought, you know, when you hear about somebody, you know, some herb that's going to treat, you know, somebody who's been bitten by a bushmaster or something like that, and I always thought, oh, that probably couldn't work. Well, there was a study about 10 years ago that I came across. And they tested a whole bunch of herbs, and I think this was in South America or Central America, that were traditional snake bite remedies. And every single one of those herbs denatured the venom. And, you know, think about it. When we're looking at indigenous people, they didn't have the luxury of going to the hospital. They didn't have the luxury of anti-venom. So if they continue to use an herb and they tell you, you know, we use it for this, well, you know what? There's a darn good chance that they're right, because if they weren't, people died. And if people kept dying from snake bite when you used remedy A, guess what? They stopped using remedy A and they looked for something else. So we really need to understand that, you know, indigenous people in many cases may have been preliterate and certainly did not have technology like we did, but they were keen observers of their environment and their lives depended on it. They weren't distracted like we are with our televisions and our computers and our cell phones. And my God, the number of people who I have seen walking down the street on a cell phone who don't know where they're going and almost get run over is astonishing. Well, in traditional societies, they had to pay attention because if you wanted to survive, it was essential. And so we need to give greater credence to traditional uses of these things. Next slide, please. Now, our next herb is evening primrose. Now, all of you, I would imagine, wow, 220, nice. I would imagine the vast majority of you have heard of evening primrose, but what you've heard of is evening primrose seed oil. I don't use evening primrose seed oil at all. It's expensive and it's underwhelming. Yeah, there's some studies showing it helps with dysmenorrhea, and it also helped with, you know, some other conditions, but I have lots of stuff I could use there. What people don't understand, American herbalist, is the great part of evening primrose is not the seed oil, it's the herb itself. And the herb is the root bark, the leaves, and the flowers. Evening primrose herb, and you can use all of those parts combined. You can use any one of those. You can use it as a tea. You can use it as a tincture. So what I do every year is I go out and I gather some of the roots. And you want to remember, evening primrose is a biennial, two-year life cycle. So you want to get the root either in the autumn of the first year or early spring before it starts growing in the second year. And you use the root bark. And it's a sort of a thin layer over a woody root. The woody root's inert. So you can use the root bark if you choose, although that diminishes the, you know, the plant. It's not going to flower and seed. Or you can gather the leaves, or you can wait and gather the flowers. You can mix them together. You can use them individually. And I would mention, as a tea, the plant has a very peculiar bitter flavor with a weird aftertaste that a lot of people are not going to be particularly happy with. So for that reason, I tend to use it as a tincture. Last night in my two-year herb studies program, we're in our therapeutics module now, and so last night we did a class on differential treatment of depression and anxiety, which actually I believe I will be teaching that class at the American Herbalist Guild Conference in November this year. And one of the things that people don't realize is that if you just sit there and say, okay, St. John's wort's the depression herb, no it isn't. There are more than 15 types of depression, and if you use, and St. John's wort only really works for three of those. So if you just use St. John's wort, you know, indiscriminately because somebody has depression, you're doing them a disservice. Chances are, number one, it's not going to work very well. And then people say, oh, you know, I tried herbs, it didn't work. Well, you tried a herb probably for the wrong condition. Remember, great herbalists don't treat disease, we treat people. So therefore, it's imperative that you learn how to determine the appropriate herb for the person that you are working with. Stop thinking about the disease. Start thinking about the person who has the disease. So anyway, evening primrose is the best, single best herb we have for treating GI-based depression. And even back in the late 60s when I started studying herbal medicine, my teachers told me at that time, that when somebody's depressed, one of the first things you do is look at their GI function. And it turns out, both based on things that we did not know in 1969, based on both the enteric brain in the gut and the intestinal microbiome in the lumen of the large intestine, what we know is that the gut flora and the enteric brain have great significance on our mental health and our ability to maintain a calm, focused, and positive outlook. So evening primrose is used for people who are gloomy, apathetic, who have chronic digestive upset. And when you have a person who is depressed, they're gloomy, they're apathetic, they just have, you know, no energy, and they have all sorts of GI problems, gas, bloating, borborygmus, which is that intense intestinal rumbling. Maybe they have IBS or IBD. Maybe they have leaky gut syndrome. Maybe they have intestinal dysbiosis. But they have chronic GI issues with this sort of gloomy, despondent depression. evening primrose is phenomenal. Now, do I use it as a simple? I don't use anything as a simple. I don't treat simple people. I treat complicated people, and I use complex formulas. But it is a great starting point. It is also used for a second type of depression called hepatic depression, which means it's liver-based depression. And whereas the person with GI-based depression is gloomy and apathetic, the person with liver-based depression tends to have a sour stomach, a sour attitude. They eat fats, they get bilious, they're depressed, and they get angry easily. So they're depressed, and the one time they're not showing depression is when they have that fly off the handle anger. They also may have red eyes, red head, all signs of liver-based issues. In addition, evening primrose is also wonderful for treating both IBS, that's an irritable bowel syndrome, and it is also useful as part of a protocol for treating IBD, which is inflammatory bowel disease. That would be most commonly Crohn's disease or ulcerative colitis, but it can also be used for fibrosing proctitis, and it can also be used for things like celiac to help heal the gut mucosa, along with things like turmeric and calendula and plantain leaf and aloe gel. So evening primrose, phenomenal herb. Let me try to speed ahead because I'm not getting as many done as I'd like because I always talk too much. Next slide, Stephen. The next one is garlic mustard, which is a really obnoxious weed. Now, the nice thing is you, with the young leaves, not the ones you're looking at in the picture, but the young leaves taste great. They taste like a combination of mustard and garlic. So garlic mustard leaves and salads, the young leaves, are really delightful, especially if you like those two flavors. This plant is also allelopathic, which means it gives off chemicals that basically suppress the growth of a lot of other plants. And it tends to grow, even though in the picture there it's growing in a field, this plant often grows in woodlands. And so it is a real problem for a lot of our native, small native slow-growing plants because it suppresses their growth and it also chokes them out. So this is a plant that you want to gather prolifically. And with garlic mustard, in addition to the fact that you can eat it in salads, garlic mustard makes amazing, the young leaves make amazing pesto. So for those of you who like pesto, it's great. You can steam the leaves. You can saute the leaves. They are high in nutrition. And they have a lot of those garlic and mustard oils which have both antibacterial activity, anti-tumor activity. In addition to that, in English folk medicine, the fresh leaves of garlic mustard were boiled in honey, where the fresh juice was used as a really powerful diuretic for people with edema and cardiac edema, what used to be called dropsy. They would also take the fresh juice and boil it down and mix it with honey and make a cough syrup. And it actually is a very useful cough syrup. It can be used for coughs. It can be used for, it has anti-asthmatic activity. It can be used for bronchitis, all of those things. And so, interesting plant, and one again, because of its aggressiveness, I really want to encourage people to use much, much more of. Stephen, next slide. And so next we have goldenrod. Now, the goldenrods are generally the solidagos, so you have solidago viguaria and solidago gigantea, solidago canadensis, and most of the plants we're looking at are introduced species. This is interesting, and it's one of the few Native American weeds that we have that we've exported, and so it's now a weed in Europe. Now, the euthamias are the flat-top goldenrods. They used to be solidagos, but they decided to give them their own genus of euthamia. And so the one you are looking at there is euthamia, probably graminifolia. And just you can kind of ignore the butterfly. Generally, when you find it, it won't necessarily have a butterfly on it. And so these have narrow leaves. It is really aromatic, and they have the flat-top clusters rather than the plume or raceme of flowers that some of the other goldenrods have. Goldenrod is a fantastic non-irritating diuretic. And so many of our strong diuretics, like juniper berry, can actually really irritate the kidneys. Buchu can irritate the kidneys. But not goldenrod, very unlikely. So it can be used as a antiseptic diuretic for people with kidney infections, bladder infections, urethral infections. It also is a profound anti-inflammatory. It's traditionally used both in this country by native people and in Europe as well, and mixed with other herbs for arthritis, and it's especially used to treat gout and gouty arthritis. So it fits into the category of what is called an antidiscratic. An antidiscratic is an alterative, and for those of you who don't know what an alterative is, an alterative in the books you will read, an alterative is an herb that alters an unhealthy state to a healthy state. Well, wow, that is so nonspecific that's meaningless. How many of you are taking herbs to alter a healthy state to an unhealthy state? An alterative is an herb that enhances normal eliminatory function via the major eliminatory organ, the kidneys, the liver, the bowel, the skin, the lungs, the lymph. And so if something is dramatically, you know, a stimulant laxative, it's not an alterative. If somebody causes, you know, really profuse diuresis or diaphoresis, it wouldn't usually be considered a alterative. Now, alterative that work via the fluid via the kidneys and affect fluid metabolism are called antidiscratics, and they are generally used. They're used for arthritis in general, but they're really used for gouty arthritis and gout. And goldenrod is actually a very effective antidiscratic. It also lowers blood pressure, and it does it as a diuretic. And in fact, about 15 years ago, there was a huge study called the All-Hat study. And in the All-Hat study, they weren't looking at herbal diuretics. They were looking at pharmaceutical ones, like it was either Lasix or hydrochlorothiazide. But what they found was that simple diuretics, especially for people with hypertension who are elderly, simple diuretics were safer and just as effective as beta blockers, calcium channel blockers, and ACE inhibitors. And the people who wrote the study said, this is going to change how we prescribe and treat hypertension. The study was on something like 15,000 people. It changed nothing, unfortunately. Interestingly enough, one human study I'll mention about Solidago is that people who had indwelling catheters, so this is people who have to have a catheter all the time, a urinary catheter, taking goldenrod on a regular basis helped reduce microbial colonization and help prevent biofilm development, which is what the bacteria secrete to protect themselves from things like antibiotics. And so it would make great sense for somebody with an indwelling urinary catheter to take goldenrod on a regular basis. You should, though. Goldenrod is not a potassium-sparing diuretic, so you definitely want to increase your potassium intake, and that's easily done through diet. Wow, an hour goes by quick. Next slide, please. Our next slide is ground ivy, Glaucoma heteracea. And ground ivy is in the mint family. And a fair number of American herbalists are familiar with ground ivy. And what they know about ground ivy is it's used for as a respiratory herb. And that's true, it is. Ground ivy is used for hot, damp respiratory tract infections. So hot, damp pneumonia, hot, damp bronchitis, hot, damp coughs. And again, hot, inflammatory, painful cough, fever, the mucus is going to be yellow, green, or bloody. That tells, and a lot of it, that tells you it's hot, damp. So it works really well there. But ground ivy does a lot of other things as well. It is used in Chinese medicine to enhance passage of kidney stones and gallstones. In this case, I think it may work a little better for gallstones, but you have to be sure before you try to pass it to make sure the stone is small enough to pass. Elsewise, you're going to have a person who's going to wind up in the hospital in screaming pain. It also increases bile secretion. It also helps with gallbladder, people who have stasis of the gallbladder, they're not secreting enough bile, and the sphincter is not really opening and dumping bile. It works really nicely there. Now, years ago, and one of my first herb books, this would have been back in the late 60s, two of my first herb books, one was Back to Eden by Jethro Kloss, which had some good stuff in it. Some stuff's not as good, but it had some really good stuff in it. And then my second book, which is a book I still love today, was Maud Greaves' Modern Herbal. And this is a book that is absolutely still worth having, even though it was written in 1931 and it's hardly modern in 2014. It's still a great herbal. And she talked about ground ivy being used to treat what's called painter's colic. And I didn't know what painter's colic was, so I looked it up. And this is, of course, before the internet and before computers, so looking it up meant going to the library and looking up in a medical dictionary. And it turns out that painter's colic is an old name for lead poisoning. And I wondered about this. I thought, well, is it good for lead poisoning symptoms, meaning it just helps relieve the symptoms, or would it actually help somebody who had lead poisoning? And I wondered about this for years until one day I had a new patient, and the mother brought in her son, a young kid, who had lead poisoning. And I thought, well, I'll give it a try. And We put ground ivy in this child's formula, and lo and behold, his lead excretion, his urinary lead excretion, increased dramatically, and his blood lead levels dropped. And I was like, wow, this is amazing. I've been using ground ivy to reduce lead levels for probably 30 years or more. And of course, taught it widely as well. And not only have I had that experience, but lots of people that I've taught about it have seen the exact same thing. Ground ivy helps increase lead excretion. I'm going to try to do two more herbs, and then we'll go to questions. And if we have a lot of questions, we'll finish out with questions. And if we don't have a lot of questions, we'll actually do a few more herbs. So our next herb is a really aggressive weed. This is honeysuckle, Lanicera japonica. The Chinese name is Jingyinghua, which means gold silver flower. And you can see the flowers are yellow and white, hence gold and silver. In Chinese medicine, Jingyinghua, the unopened flowers, so what you see there are mostly open, but if you look to the right of the screen, you'll see a little tubular white flower. That's the unopened flower. Those are what are gathered. And, I mean, I come across huge patches of honeysuckle, but my God, gathering huge amounts of honeysuckle flower would be a labor of love. And most I think I've ever done with myself in a class was we gathered enough to make maybe about a quarter of a pound, and that was over a period of weeks. Because once you dry them down, there's not a lot of weight. Anyway, honeysuckle is used to clear damp heat, so it is used for a whole range of damp heat and blood heat, which, what does that mean? It means infections. It's used for respiratory tract infections. It's used for urinary tract infections. It's used for gastrointestinal infections. It's used for influenza. It's used for colds. This stuff is wonderful. And in fact, traditionally, it was combined with Chinese coptis. And during the days when they used to have the barefoot doctors, the combination of honeysuckle and Chinese coptis was known as poor man's penicillin. Now, it's not. And in fact, I'm sure many of you have seen things talking about herbal antibiotics. There are no herbal antibiotics. An antibiotic and antibacterial are two different things. No herbs actually do what an antibiotic does. But there are plenty of herbs that are antibacterial, and there are many herbs that have significant benefits for viral conditions, even though we're not actually sure in most cases whether they actually are directly antiviral. We actually don't really know very well what the herbs we call antiviral are doing. We don't know if they're actually inhibiting the virus unless they are coming in direct contact with the virus. So if you're actually putting, if you're putting something like ground ivy and you boil it down or lemon balm or licorice and you put it on a herpetic sore, yes, it's antiviral. But if you took it internally, we actually have very little evidence that it has an antiviral effect. Yet, we know that a lot of these herbs are good for viral conditions. We're just not sure what they're doing and how. Nevertheless, Lanicera is useful for viral conditions or bacterial conditions, and it has a wide spectrum of use. In addition to this, the stem of honeysuckle, which is called rendantong, honeysuckle stem is used for arthritic symptoms, especially if the arthritis is red and hot. I would especially combine the honeysuckle stem with herbs such as sarsaparilla and gota cola. Works really nicely for inflammatory arthritis. It can be osteoarthritis that's inflammatory or rheumatoid arthritis that is inflammatory. And we'll end up with our herbs, unless we don't have a lot of questions, with the next one, which is Japanese knotweed. Japanese knotweed, they relatively recently changed the name. So actually that's misspelled. It should be two L's, I believe. It's Fallopia japonica. It used to be Pelargonium cuspidatum. So they've changed the name and just love the botanists. They do like to change names. The young shoots are edible, but they have a lot of oxalic acid in them, so people who have oxalate kidney stones probably will want to stay away from the shoots. And the shoots are usually cooked. They can be made into soups. They can be made into tempura. But the part of this that is primarily used as medicine is the root. Japanese knotweed is one of the most aggressive plants I've ever seen. I have seen patches of Japanese knotweed where they bulldozed it, they covered it with asphalt, and a month later the Japanese knotweed is growing through the asphalt. Now, Japanese knotweed, the root, is one of the richest sources of the phytochemical resveratrol, which is a still bean. And still beans are powerfully anti-inflammatory. And remember, most of our chronic degenerative disease, whether we're talking about cancer, heart disease, atherosclerosis, diabetes, arthritis, autoimmune diseases, are inflammatory in nature. So taking things that help reduce systemic inflammation can not only help prevent some of these chronic degenerative diseases, they can also be part of a protocol for treating these conditions. Japanese knotweed has a long history of use in Chinese medicine. It is used to relieve damp heat. And again, there's hot heat, there's inflammation, there's fever, and a lot of the discharge. So it's used for dysentery, bacterial diarrhea. It's also used for viral diarrhea. So if you had that lovely norovirus this winter, where for a couple days, and some people it's not a couple days, some people it's a week or more, where everything you eat is just going through and coming out pure liquid and you are just feeling horrible, this could be really useful there. For jaundice, appendicitis, hepatitis, enteritis, this is a major herb for those type of damp heat conditions. In addition, it is traditionally used both orally and topically to treat snake bites, to treat rheumatoid arthritis. I have used Japanese knotweed for 20 years for treating Lyme arthralgia. Now, you will also read that Japanese knotweed cures Lyme disease. It does not. And it's probably one of the people who's treated more people with Lyme disease than anyone else in the United States. Do not fall into the belief that you can easily treat Lyme disease with herbs. Herbs can be useful. Japanese knotweed is great for chronic Lyme arthralgia, and it is really effective for post-Lyme arthralgia. It's one of the herbs I use, along with things like teasel root and things of that nature. But curing Lyme disease, I've seen way too many people with chronic Lyme disease, and you do not want to risk that and risk your health, because it can be really nasty. Anyway, it is also used for damp heat conditions of the lung. It's used for pneumonia. It's used for bronchitis. It's used for pleurisy. This is a powerful medicine that until recently most American herbalists had no idea how to use it or what to use. And nowadays, of course, everybody's promoting it as a quote-unquote cure for Lyme, which, as I said, it has benefits, but it is not a cure. So with that, let's see if we have any questions. Stephen, I don't get to see the questions, I guess. So are you going to
I'll read the questions to you. First, I just wanted to say something about the American Herbalist Guild, who's sponsoring this webinar series, and because we have quite a few people, I think, who may not be members of the Guild, but this is one of our free webinars for the general public, but we also have a lot of webinars that are available for our members, and general membership is quite easy. You get the great Journal of American Herbalist Guild, with lots of good information.
It's a great journal.
Yeah, a great journal. And so, you know, consider joining the Guild and supporting the cause of herbalists and herbal practitioners. The information is there on your screen. So let's go ahead and pull up some of the questions that have been asked. And first of all, someone asked about the three books that you mentioned right in the beginning by the Eclectics that you thought were really valuable.
Well, you have King's Dispensatory by Felter and Lloyd, which is available on Henriette's website and other websites. So you would just put in King's Dispensatory and it'll pull it up. If you Google it or whatever. The next one was Ellingwood's American Materia Medica, also available online. And the third one was Felter's, Eclectic Materia Medica. And so these are all really worthwhile books, and there's lots of websites. You have sites like Michael Moore, the late Michael Moore's website. He has lots of books you can download for free. My website, herbaltherapeutics.net, where I have tons of stuff from my library where you can just download it for free off the website. And there are other Henriette Kress's website, which has great information. There are lots of great informational websites out there where you can get great material at absolutely no charge.
And by the way, you need to mention your school.
Yes. Well, if anybody is interested, the next program for my two-year program, which is called David Winston Center for Herbal Studies, and the website is herbalstudies.net. So herbalstudies.net, if you want to check it out. It's a two-year program for training clinical herbalists, and it is one of the most, one of the most comprehensive programs in the U.S. And the good news is, for the last 6 years, it is not only live in New Jersey, but it is also live online. So that means people can be anywhere. We now have students all over the United States, Canada, England, Ireland, Iceland, Liechtenstein, Costa Rica, and Australia. And so as long as you have a high-speed internet connection, you can be a part of that class. And it's a wonderful class. And so if anybody's interested, please go to the website, herbalstudies.net, and check it out.
Great.
All right. So
a couple of questions about barberry. Someone said barberry is drying. Would it cause problems if you used it in a douche?
Barberry is not really that drying. Barberry only has a slight drying quality. Great. Phone's ringing. Barberry only has a slight drying quality, so therefore it is not something that is going to be a problem. If you are concerned, what you can do is you could always add something moistening to it. But barberry does not have a high level of tannin, so it's not like something like oak bark or bayberry bark or alum root or witch hazel or something like that, which are strong astringents.
If you're going to use it as a mouthwash, would you use a decoction?
I would definitely use a decoction.
Mm-hmm. Okay. What are the other herbs that you combine with honeysuckle and gotocola for arthritic conditions?
Well, it depends on the arthritis, but if you're talking about a hot, damp arthritis, the herbs that I mentioned were, you know, things like gotocola, sarsaparilla, would be the specific indications for both of those herbs are tissue that is red hot and inflamed. So those are two good herbs. But remember, a good herbalist is not treating arthritis. You're treating the person that has arthritis. So you're really looking at the person. And so that person, is going to have other issues. And so you're looking at that person, and you're looking at the nature of the pain. So if their arthritic pain is dull and throbbing, you might want to add horse chestnut. If the arthritic pain is sharp and stabbing, you might add something like sweet melilotus. If the arthritic pain is more, let's say, in the lines of sort of peripheral nerve pain, then you might look at something like prickly ash or St. John's wort. So you're going to add it in based on the specifics of the symptom picture that that person has.
Great. Someone asked about how you use the ground ivy. Do you use a tea, tincture? How do you use that plant?
You could use it as a tea, but the tea tastes gross.
Okay.
So therefore, I'm more likely to use a tincture because you can use a very small amount of tincture, which you can then, you know, put in juice or something like that, as opposed to having to drink way larger amount of tea that most people are going to find somewhat objectionable.
Great. Would ground ivy be safe to use during pregnancy if you were trying to get rid of lead?
That's not the time to get rid of lead. And generally, ground ivy is not used during pregnancy. So, you know, if you think you have a lead issue, try doing it before you get pregnant. And if you are pregnant and you think you have lead, then you might try something like sodium alginate.
Okay. Can coral honeysuckle, Lanicera sempervirens, be used interchangeably?
Yes. No, it's not. Unfortunately, it does not have the same activity.
Okay. Should the Japanese knotweed root be dried first, or can it be made into an extract when it's fresh?
there's no benefit about making it into a fresh tincture. You don't lose anything by drying it. So personally, I dry it first before I tincture it. You know, with tincturing, there's certain herbs that are way better fresh, and there's some herbs that drying them just that you lose all their activity. There's some herbs that are way better made fresh. There's some herbs that fresh or dry are pretty much, you know, equal, although sometimes they kind of make different products, meaning they have slightly different effects. And then there's some things where dry is actually vastly superior to fresh. And in the case of Japanese knotweed, you're going to get a much stronger and better extract from the properly dried root than from the fresh root.
Great. What part of the Japanese knotweed is used topically for arthritis? It's all the root, isn't it?
Well, it's, yeah, the only part that's used is root, but it's mostly used internally.
Yeah, okay, so it's used internally. Mm-hmm. Let's see. Can you spell out the essential oil that comes from Canadian fleabane? They wanted to make sure they got that.
Erigeron is E-R-I-G-E-R-O-N, I think. Although spelling in my head is not my strong point. Let me write it down here. Yeah, I think it's E-R-I-G-E-R-O-N.
Okay. Two people asked about the modern herb medicine book. I guess they're asking about the Greaves book. So just...
Yeah, Greaves Modern Herbal.
Yeah, Modern Herbal.
What about it?
They just wanted to get the name of the author and the title of the book so that they could...
Maud Grieve, A Modern Herbal. It's available in reprints both from Dover, which is in paperback, and I've also seen hardcover reprints as well. It's inexpensive and really well worth having. But remember, if you're looking at any of the material in there that's science-based, it's way out of date. But the traditional uses, the history, that kind of information is awesome.
Someone said they really loved the information you gave on the snake bite and wondered if there was any source they could go to study more about traditional remedies for snake bite.
Well, I unfortunately can't pull up the name of the study that I came across, but if you go on PubMed, for those of you who are unfamiliar, PubMed is the National Library of Medicine in Washington, and you just go on Google and put in PubMed, it'll pull it up. And if you go to PubMed and it has virtually every study that's, you know, major study that's published is on PubMed, usually just abstracts, but probably about 10 to 15% of the time you can actually get the full article through PubMed. And if you put, herbs and snake bite, it will pull up some interesting articles probably that will at least give you information. And if it's only the abstract, you can go to your local community college or local medical school and go to their library, and they probably will have that information there, and you could, you know, copy it or get a I know my local community college, they even make copies for, if you're a county resident, for free.
Someone asked about what was the best preparation of goldenrod for gout. Is it the tea or the tincture, or both, or either?
Either one can be used. You can use either one, but let me tell you, my favorite herbs for treating gout, there are two, parsley and celery seed. So if I was going to use goldenrod, I would use a combination of equal parts celery seed, parsley, that's the leaf, not the seed, and goldenrod. And you could do that as a tea or a tincture, and it can be very, very effective for treating gout and or gouty arthritis.
And someone said, do you have a recommendation for a good reference on herbalism for the GI tract?
Well, if you could find a copy of my article on herbal nutritional gastroenterology, it's darn good. I just actually taught that this past weekend in Phoenix. Eric Yarnell has a book on naturopathic treatment of naturopathic gastroenterology. And he has his own publishing company. I totally cannot remember the name. It's up in Washington State someplace, but it's Eric Yarnell, and it's Naturopathic Gastroenterology. Christopher Hobbs had a nice book out that may be out of print. It was called, I think it was called The Liver Foundation of Health or something like that, which talked about, you know, liver issues. Off the top of my head, those are probably the two that I can think of, but there are probably others, but there really are not a lot of books on that topic that are specific on that topic. There's lots of, every herb book touches on the topic, but that are specific to gastroenterology, not as much as there should be.
Okay. A couple of just general things. We don't want to get into doing questions that involve asking, like, how do you treat this or how do you treat that? Because it's not that simplistic. As David Winston said, you work on the person, not the illness. So you have to have information about the case in order to really come up with what good recommendations are for specific problems. So I'm not reading people those questions. And the second thing is, quite a few of you have asked, has this been recorded? And yes, it's being recorded, and it will be posted on the American Herbalist Guild website. So if you missed part of it, you'll be able to get it and download it and listen to it again and take whatever notes you'd like. And that is pretty much all of the questions relevant to what we've been talking about tonight, David. So do you want to take time to go backwards and pick up a couple of the herbs we missed?
Well, I would be happy to do that because we have about 10 minutes. So if we can go, we were a Japanese knotweed. If you can go to kudzu,
okay,
that would be great.
I'll find kudzu for you. And
then maybe we'll skip around and I'll sort of cherry pick a few herbs that I'd really like to talk about since we only have 10 minutes.
You're right. Just let's cover a few more.
All right, so I think if we go past Japanese knotweed, I think one more.
Yep.
We'll get to kudzu.
There we go.
All right, so kudzu, you know, it's amazing. Kudzu was brought to the United States to help prevent erosion, and it worked. Where you have kudzu, you have no erosion. It's the plant that ate the Southeast. And it amazes me that to this day we import thousands of pounds of dried kudzu from China for people who use it as a Chinese medicine, and we import probably thousands of pounds of kuzu starch from Japan for people who use it in macrobiotic cooking, and yet we have huge amounts of kudzu growing all over the Southeast, and it's amazing to me that somebody hasn't set up a cottage industry. Farmers would pay you to get rid of stuff out of their fields and off of, you know, it basically kills trees. It's just incredibly aggressive. I've seen kudzu roots that were bigger than my leg, thicker than my thigh, and longer than my leg. It's an astonishing plant. Now, here's the thing. Kudzu has a very long history of use both in Japan and China. It is a great medicine. Some of you may be familiar with the fact that kudzu has been promoted as a herb to help people stop drinking alcohol. Interestingly enough, the flowers, which you see in the picture there, which smell, by the way, like Welch's grape jelly. The flowers traditionally were used for what was called alcohol poisoning. They were used to treat hangovers. And while it is true that drinking kudzu as a tea, and you'd use it as decoction, will modestly help reduce somebody's alcohol intake if they want to reduce their alcohol intake, if you expect it to take somebody who is a, you know, an alcoholic and it's going to make them like they never want to drink again, your expectations are too high. On the other hand, kudzu root, and it's generally used as a decoction or as the tincture of the dry root, is an incredible medicine, and it's incredibly versatile. It is an antispasmodic. It's used especially for nexums, so people who wake up with their neck sort of, they can't straighten out, it's called torticollis or wry neck, phenomenal herb. It's used for angina pain. It's used for bowel spasms. So it's used especially for treating IBS symptoms. Kudzu also is anti-inflammatory to the GI tract. So it not only can be used for treating IBS, it can also be used for treating inflammatory bowel disease. Kudzu also acts as an antihistamine, so it can be used for people who have seasonal allergies. And there I combine it with other sort of flavonoid-rich herbs like blueberry solid extract or maybe fresh eyebright tincture can work incredibly well. So kudzu is an amazing medicine that is just underutilized, underappreciated, and if we start using it aggressively, maybe we can keep it from, you know, proceeding to eat the rest of the Southeast that it hasn't managed to do already. So we're going to skip ahead, Stephen, and
okay,
Past the next slide, and we're going to go to the next one, which is mimosa. The Chinese name is hehuangpi, which means collective happiness peel. Now the flowers, hehuanghua, also can be used, but the flowers are really feeble. They're not very strong. On the other hand, the bark is astonishing. Mimosa bark is used in Chinese medicine, and mimosa has become a really weedy tree in the southeast. So again, this is growing all over the southeast. It was planted as an ornamental, it escaped, and now it's everywhere. So mimosa is the single greatest mood elevator I have ever come across. And so, you know, when people take antidepressants, whether they be SSRIs or SNRIs, it doesn't make you happy. It just helps you to get through the day. And I see a lot of people who I've treated who are taking antidepressants, and they just are emotionally flat. They've got like this, you know, sort of flat effect. And, you know, they're not happy, but they can kind of get through the day and still live their, you know, their life, which in many cases they hate their job, they're not happy with the relationship, this is not going right. And you kind of say, of course they're depressed. If, you know, and for many people, I think depression is actually a normal response to living a very unhealthy and unsustainable life. Mimosa is real interesting. Mimosa, you start taking it, and after a couple weeks, you find yourself wandering around with this huge smile on your face. And somebody comes up to you and says, wow, you're in a good mood. And you just kind of look, think about it for a minute and go, wow, I really am. And they see this big smile and say, why are you so happy? And you look at them and go, I have no idea. It is the greatest mood elevator I have ever seen. And I use it for treating everything from broken hearts to chronic grief to what's called stagnant depression, which is chronic situational depression, and I use it for treating PTSD. Now, for somebody with PTSD, do not give this to somebody who has PTSD unless they're ready to deal with their stuff and they have a good therapist to help them work through it, because it's going to come up quick and fast. So people who are like not ready to deal with their stuff, don't give it. Also, don't give it to people who are bipolar. It'll push them right into a manic phase. So there are places you don't want to use mimosa. But for people who, you know, something bad happened in their life and it's 5 or 10, 15 years later and they're still stuck there and that event has become the sun and they're now a planet orbiting that event, it is phenomenal. On the other hand, somebody loses a loved one, just don't rush to give them this. Because in America, we all think we're supposed to be happy all the time. What people don't understand is, as unpleasant as grief is, there are two things in your life that are going to force you to grow, love and pain. And we don't want to skip them because the things that make us human, one of them is grief. One of them is understanding the impermanence of life and how important it is to live your life fully and to appreciate the people in your life fully. And if we never lose someone and feel that pain of loss, we never learn those lessons. So this is for somebody who, after a period of time, has grieved or has a broken heart, and they're feeling ready. They want to move on, but they can't. That's when you use something like mimosa. It's also, by the way, also used for cold, damp musculoskeletal conditions. So it's used for like arthritis. It's worse when it's cold or rainy and things like that. So it has that effect as well. But primarily it is used as a phenomenal mood elevator. And Stephen, with that, I think we've got about 2 minutes. Are there any last questions?
Let me just pull that up. I just want to say this is phenomenal. I always love listening to you. I found mimosa growing here, and I've been picking it. The flowers are kind of heady, you know.
Yeah.
When you tincture them. Okay. Does mimosa get used as an essential oil?
Not that I'm aware of.
How are you using the bark?
The dried bark can be made into a decoction or it can be made into a tincture. I usually do it as a tincture. And one of the things about tinctures, you know, some people are like paranoid about alcohol. Now, if you are a recovering alcoholic, don't use tinctures. And I hate to burst anybody's bubble, but if you drop a tincture in hot water, it does not evaporate the alcohol. In order to evaporate alcohol out of a tincture, you have to boil it. And that would damage most tinctures. So for somebody with alcohol abuse issues, do not use tinctures. But the reality is for the average person, the amount of alcohol is pretty insignificant, and alcohol increases the absorption of whatever you're putting it in by about 30%. So it is a great preservative, it's a great extracting medium, and it increases absorption of whatever you're taking. A lot of it is absorbed sublingually right under your tongue. So there are benefits. And so I do use a lot of tinctures, but I use a lot of teas. I do occasionally use capsules, much less. I think they're the most poorly absorbed products. I'll occasionally use vinegar extracts, glycerates, things of that nature. But tinctures and teas are by far my most common form of delivery. And, Stephen, that brings us to 8:30. So
yep.
I want to thank everybody for spending an hour and a half with me tonight. It's been an absolute pleasure. I've enjoyed sharing some of my favorite weedy herbs with you, and I hope each and every one of you has some information and have found it useful and has information that you didn't have before, and go out there and use those weeds.
From both myself and the people who are commenting, we loved it. So thanks, David.
You're very welcome. Have a great evening, everyone.